Hello, everyone, and welcome to Just DAO It, the podcast for people starting DAOs. I'm Adam Miller, and I'm your host. Prior to starting my DAO, which provides legal entity solutions for DAOs, I was doing consulting for people starting and operating DAOs. We have two really awesome guests on the show today. So before we get into some business, let's let them each introduce themselves. So who would like to go first?
You got it, Django.
All right. Django. I contributed heavily to the first iteration of the Juicebox protocol and supported heavily lots of projects in its early phase and kind of stewarded a lot of the architecture and protocol aspects of it as it has evolved through a risk mitigation security-oriented chapter to make sure the foundation is safe for people to build on into an evolution that it's taking on now. So more involved in the research and protocol architecture side of things, but I've been here since the beginning, and it's never more exciting than now.
Hell yeah. Love it. All right, Philip, your second time on the show, unless I'm forgetting one. I think second. So welcome back.
Yeah, second time. Yeah, thanks for having us. So my name is Philip, also working on Juicebox, but a little bit more on kind of the side directly with project. So I've been helping out project creators and also working on things related to the DAO. So things like governance, a little bit of help with front end and a bunch of other various projects the DAO has going on, operations and that kind of stuff. So a little bit less on the research side, more on the everything else side of Juicebox DAO.
Awesome. Love it. All right. And as our audience, many of you probably already know, the first half of the show will be the Just DAO It News Report, where I will summarize recent DAO news from the past few weeks for the audience and for you guys. And we will dig into those stories. Do we agree, disagree with the author? What does it tell us about what's happening in the world of DAOs? What's meaningful to people that may be newer to DAOs about these articles? And in the second half of the podcast, we will go into a more in-depth interview with our two guests about their history in Web3, what they're working on, and advice and ideas for people that are starting DAOs today. So turning to the Just DAO It News Report, the first article of the week, actually it's a post, it's from DCF God on X, and the tweet is, and I'm actually not going to read it, I'm going to summarize it. So this tweet is talking about a session that took place at ETH Denver a couple weeks ago, that what I think is the biggest crypto conference in America of the year, at least one of the biggest, and all three of us were there. One of the talks was a panel with one of the folks from Aragon on stage. And the moderator really started digging into the Aragon person, a woman named Jess, actually is a wonderful person and a great contributor to the space, really started digging into her about what's been going on at Aragon over the past several months and even couple of years, got really critical, which is, I think is good for a moderator to do. Jess responded, well, what I want to talk about is the situation. So what is it that they were talking about? Why was this such a popular thing to comment about, and why is it getting people's attention? So, you know, Aragon, first of all, is a popular, one of the early popular tools that helps you launch smart contracts to run a DAO. So the smart contracts that allow you to track who has how much governance rights and manage the treasury on chain and vote on the treasury. And because Aragon was so early, they're one of the first DAO tooling projects. They raised, I think, something like 20 million in Ethereum back in 2018, 2016, but way back when. And so that Ethereum has now grown in value to what is now, you know, something like $100 million. And it was raised into a foundation structure. Foundations have boards. So there's a board of what they call the Aragon DAO. You'll see why this gets a little complicated in a second. Over time, the board and the foundation have decided to go in a different direction from the Aragon project, essentially, is my read. They've basically decided to give back the money to the donors, dissolve the foundation, give a little bit of the money to the team that's actually working on the Aragon protocol, and otherwise go their separate ways. And the conflict here comes from folks like DCF God. Now, DCF God is a, I've been told, is a known kind of like a corporate raider of sorts who looks for situations where a DAO is struggling and tries to take advantage of the situation financially. So DCF God may have some ulterior motives, and I know this is getting complicated already, but ulterior motives aside, DCF God is kind of speaking on behalf of the token holders here and saying, wait a second, why is the foundation allowed to just decide whatever they want to do with all of our money and like give it back to themselves, for example? Why don't the token holders get to decide? This is, they call it a DAO. And I think there's a really good point here where for years people have thought of Aragon as a DAO. It operates in some ways as a DAO. They've built DAO tooling as well, so people have high expectations for them. And yet, it turns out they have a board, and the board can just decide to give all the money back. Now, one of the problematic things about giving the money back, to me, but I'm not an expert in Swiss associations law, and I'm not a lawyer, but one of the problems to me is that they're not just giving back $20 million. They're giving back $100 million or more dollars. So it's a nonprofit association, raised $20 million, giving back $100 million. That sounds like almost like a for-profit enterprise. What they would say is, well, we got a bunch of ETH and we're giving back the same amount of ETH. So maybe that's a little bit complicated. To me, the bigger question is just like, if you have a foundation and you have a board, is it really a DAO? And to me, usually the answer is no. Like it's if you have five people who look at how people vote and decide whether they want to do that thing or not, to me, that's just not a DAO. And it's one of the reasons I'm in the business of creating new legal structures for DAOs. But let me just stop there. I know that's a lot. Either if you'd like to respond to anything I said, especially if you disagree with anything, or just add, you know, your thoughts on this whole Aragon situation, that'd be great.
I'm curious what y'all think of as a DAO. Where do you draw the lines? Is it a piece of paper, like a legally legal decree that, yes, this is a DAO? Or is it an on-chain set of contract specifications that describes something as a DAO? Where do y'all think are the odds and ends there?
I mean, I'll give you my answer, which is really what makes it a DAO is that you're doing a fair amount of your governance and membership tracking and treasury management on chain. And so actually, if you want to have a board, that's fine. If you go into the situation saying, we're calling ourselves a DAO, it's a DAO, the voting happens on chain, but five people get to vote. They're the board of the foundation. Everyone should know that, even though that's not how most DAOs tend to work. Fine. I think there's no problem with that. I think the problem is when you set the expectation that the token holders are in charge, or you allow people to have that expectation, but behind the scenes, you've gone and created a legal structure that is does not actually reflect the wishes of the token holders. That's when there may be a problem.
Sure. So we need like a Howey test for DAOs. Like what are the check boxes that'll describe something as a DAO. It's good.
I think this is like a room for legal improvement, where if something is called an LLC, like it has LLC in the name, at least within the United States, you have certain legal guarantees around what that entails. Whereas with DAO, it's kind of this subjective thing. And, you know, of course, some jurisdictions are starting to pass DAO laws where if you have DAO in the name of your entity, there are certain like guarantees that supporters will get. But for the most part, you don't really have that. So I don't know. I think structures like multi-sigs and juice box projects and these kind of on-chain things that make it very easy to do diligence by looking at the parameters are great, because you can get certain guarantees as a supporter.
Isn't that what Aragon was also supposed to be?
But the thing is, they have this legal entity that kind of underlies everything, and so it's
they
harder.
Were documenting their own.
Yes. Yeah. So if they were actually, I don't know many of the specifics, so I don't want to like say what Aragon was doing. I don't really know too much about the situation, but it's much harder to do diligence when you have to read through like the bylaws of this entity in Switzerland and like go through all these kind of processes which are hard to sort through. You know, it would be nice if you could just have those on-chain guarantees and know what you're getting into as a token holder.
Yeah,
I think for me that that guarantee aspect's important. It's like when it comes down to risk mitigation, like when things aren't going as planned, or when there's pressure by someone who may see an angle, maybe it's this Twitter account, maybe it's a legal jurisdiction or something like that. Like what is the least common denominator for risk mitigation? Is it the court of law, or is it like the contracts just won't let you do what you want to do? Because like the physical constraint of contracts there can supersede the legal jurisdiction. Like if money can't come out, money can't come out unless certain quorums or rules or whatever contractual constraints are met. But if that's not the case, if there is a key somewhere, then I guess you go up the stack to like the legal jurisdiction, in which case that'll always supersede whatever wording of like, yes, we're a DAO, you choose to impose on yourself.
And like, I think a lot of the confusion here probably comes from the fact that people assumed that Aragon itself would be similar to what Aragon, the software, makes possible for other people, right? But that turned out not to be the case. And I also think curious if you guys would agree, I think people tend to assume when you say you're a DAO, they assume you're very democratic compared to traditional forms of organization, right? And whether it's one member, one vote, or one token, one vote, I think they assume, right or wrong, they assume that you're much more democratic. And so then when you find out that a DAO is not, it can be kind of a surprise. Don't actually think DAOs have to be democratic. I think they get to choose and they just have to implement it on chain, right?
It's funny how DAO as a marketing term has been a sign of benevolence and like a positive thing. It's like, oh, you're a DAO, not a company. Oh, that's, you're in my favor then. Whereas I think a DAO is so much more a burden than it is a benefit in many operational contexts. In that description of the word, I think governance can be a massive burden. You spend a lot of your decision-making just trying to manage risks of, I don't know, takeovers or poorly written proposals going through and, you know, finding, like you're trying to deal with black and white, but inevitably you're going to be dealt with a ton of gray in between that you'd have to then like create social rules and kind of precedents and all the like. And so it's funny that it still has this marketing woo-woo of like, oh, let's just stick DAO at the end and create this impression of for the people, by the people. Whereas I think DAO can mean 1,000 things. That's the exciting bit of a DAO, is it can mean 1,000 things. Hopefully we're learning along the way such that like we can critique DAOs of yesterday while also creating productive DAOs of tomorrow. And those two things aren't the same. So we need to probably find new nuance that kind of compares and contracts what the hell a DAO is in these contexts. But yeah, I think here's a case where the marketing got ahead of the actual implementations.
Yeah, I think for something to meet the DAO definition, I might actually disagree with you, Adam. Where I think what you said makes a lot of sense. That of course there is that on-chain component, but I think for something to be like a DAO in the truest sense of the word, and very few things that are called DAOs actually meet this definition. Even Juicebox DAO probably doesn't to a full extent. But I think you want to get to a point where these gray areas and these social disagreements are actually impossible. Where whatever is happening on chain will resolve any kind of potential for conflict, and that is what goes. And it's there's no room for this kind of like social disagreement or controversy.
I would even go so far as like the exciting end game of DAO in its true autonomous form doesn't have governance at all. So you have a bunch of independent actors interacting into a common network with a common goal and focus and energy movement, but without need to manage or attend to operations or even delegate operations, because you have access to your piece of the pie. Sure, you can create sub units of governing therein, but it's not the fact that like the whole capital of the thing is at risk to governance. I think that also jeopardizes the autonomous component a little bit. It is something we, obviously it's a great feature of Web3 and really played a role in the past few years, differentiating from prior maybe board run and executive led organizations. But I think governance is a far cry from autonomous, even if it is on chain. I think it requires a lot of diligence, conversations. Like any proposal is not, even if it's on chain, it's not complete until a conversation follows that critiques and evolves and recreates the proposal with whoever shows up. And despite having a large body of participants or a larger body of initial funders who are now maybe less day-to-day present, it's usually only a few people who show up in the threads and actually pick something apart in earnest. And that's important. That's a very important role.
Yeah. It's a good segue into one of the other stories for the week. And so I want to read the headline and mention what happened, and then we'll return to what you were just talking about. This is an article from Cointelegraph, and the headline is, Wyoming passes law granting DAOs legal status. The new regulation, actually I'll skip the byline. What happened was Wyoming has passed a new law creating something called a DUNA, which stands for Decentralized Unincorporated Nonprofit Association. There already was something called an UNA, an unincorporated nonprofit association in Wyoming and several other states. And this new legal entity type, based on my conversations with the guys who wrote it, I would describe this new legal entity as almost like a legal entity for non-organizations. So, for example, let's say you have a protocol, right, some kind of DAP, and you just want to protect the people who are participating in governance from things like unlimited liability, right? And we talk about this on the show a lot, but like oftentimes if you participate in any kind of like collaborative endeavor and something goes wrong, the law says, unless you're registered with some kind of legal entity, we're going to hold everyone liable for everything that happened. So UNAs and DUNAs are a way of reducing that liability with a corporate veil, liability shield, but they're really made to not be an organization. It's just like, look, let's have a protocol. It needs to be governed. Sometimes there's going to have to be votes. Maybe it's like, what's the fee going to be? Or how much money is going to go into which liquidity pool? Or do we need to like emergency shut this thing down for some reason? But they don't think of themselves as an organization. It just so happens that like all the people using the protocol need to govern the protocol. Whereas a legal entity like the DAO LLC that I work on, this is really made for DAOs that are like, oh yeah, like we are an organization. We're a business, we're a charity, we're a nonprofit, we're a for-profit, right? We're an association. They think of themselves as an organization that does all that stuff, Django, like having meetings and community calls and trying to come to consensus and if not, making decisions other ways and having budgets and a centralized treasury. So, to me, Django, what I was hearing kind of you kind of play on is like the O of the DAO, which is like, are we really talking about organizations that now happen to be run using like decentralized autonomous technology, for example, or are we talking about protocols that like need some kind of governance sometimes, but mm-hmm. they don't think of themselves as an organization in the classic sense of the word?
It's an interesting distinction. Yeah. Like, is there room for decentralized autonomous organizations as you described? There are decisions to be made to organize around. And there might be decentralized autonomous networks, which, have another distinguishing factor of sense of belonging, or decentralized autonomous brands, or, ideas, or decentralized autonomous memes, ideas that don't require organizing, but are still, they still have an identity, right? Those are powerful.
It's like a lot of people say, oh, I don't know if I should say a lot, but at least some people say that Bitcoin is a DAO and was the first DAO. And right. I say, no, because it's not an organization. It's like it's a protocol with tons of different organizations and people involved. But I can see where they're coming from, because in some ways it fits somewhere in that picture.
Right? Yeah, we all see some semblance of organization in like the physical sense.
At least a collective. Right. And I think another thing that makes something an organization is like a collective purpose or outcome of some kind. And certainly I'd say Bitcoin has that.
Yeah, I think the anti-fragile way to phrase this would be decentralized autonomous chaos or something. then you can't lose.
Sure.
And it's still pretty cool.
I really like the damn, the decentralized autonomous meme that you. Philip, you want to weigh in here too?
No, I think you guys pretty much covered it. I mean, one thing I might be interested in seeing, one space that Django kind of alluded to, which I'm interested in seeing more innovation in, is this kind of gradient between maybe on the extreme end, you have just some kind of aligning incentive that aligns many people in one direction. And then on this end, you have kind of a classic DAO with governance and everything like that. I think there's a lot of kind of middle grounds in there where you can organize things on chain that maybe you can't do as easily with traditional markets and incentives, where you can get people to be more aligned than maybe just like a fully decentralized thing, but you don't have to deal with this governance overhead and burden. I don't know. This is like an interesting space for me.
Yep. All right. I'm going to go to the next article because we can connect it all together still. So this next article, actually, it's another post on X, and the post is from MetaDAO, which is at MetaDAO Project. And the post is introducing VOTA, a vote market on Solana. Trade your votes for cash. Now, votes and cash were emojis, but I think it's fair for me to read it this way. Trade your votes for cash, starting with the SaberDAO gauge votes. And what the MetaDAO is doing, and I guess a disclosure, this is one of our clients at MyDAO, but what MetaDAO is doing is they are very, I'm going to say shamelessly, I hope that doesn't have a negative connotation, but like shamelessly promoting that sometimes the best way to run governance is by selling the votes. And that this is an efficient and optimal way, or a great way of running certain, making certain decisions, at least. And I mean, when I hear this, my initial reaction is like, oh my goodness, that sounds scary. Like, at least clearly cannot always be the right solution, I don't think. And to be fair, like this first implementation, I think is specifically being used to manage liquidity pools on a DeFi protocol. And in that sense, this reminds me, I think, of what Curve is somewhat known for, mm-hmm. which is that there's a system a whole system developed around Curve Finance for bribing. I think they're not using the term negatively, at least themselves, but like bribing or buying votes. And then you're using those votes to like change the fees or bonuses given a certain liquidity pool for the liquidity providers. And it seems to work. I mean, I don't know a lot about how that works, but I use Curve and it seems to work well. So I'm just curious if you guys can weigh in on this at all. I don't know if you have experience with this type of system or any intuition about it.
Yeah, I think this is great, actually. Like, I love Convex. I love this. I don't know. I've spoken when Convex was picking up a lot of traction, I was speaking with friends about it. And one observation a friend made, which I think is very true, is that it's pretty consistently surprising when you hear about how much it costs to buy or to bribe like a politician in the United States. You know, I'm not endorsing this, of course, but it can sometimes be surprisingly cheap to bribe politicians. And my friend wondered, if this was like an efficient market and accessible to everybody, would we have better outcomes as a society? Because people with good intentions could kind of outbribe the bad people. So I think as DAOs, a DAO voting system governs becomes more and more important, this is kind of going to happen naturally. So by getting ahead of it and making the system efficient and accessible and kind of well-known, I think you're actually mitigating a lot of the potential risks that come with like just a DAO becoming more important, right? Like buying votes is something that happens in real world democracies all the time when there's a lot of money to be made or lost. So by setting this up now, before we get to that point where it's happening under the table, I think it's actually a very good thing.
Yes, spot on. I think it's crazy what transparency, just the idea of transparency, ends up solving. We oftentimes think we have these other problems to try to solve. Like in the technical sense, we have like MEV, like extracted value by those who are constructing blocks. In voting, we have buying voting. And so much energy, I guess in Discord, we have like spammers. We spend so much energy and priority sometimes in trying to fix those problems or like design systems to prevent those things. But they seem to all emerge somewhat organically and emerge anyways, no matter how much you try to stop it. So I really enjoy exercises of, you know, trying to look at those things, and ask, like, how can this be a feature? How can we build systems that allow this energy that's naturally emerging here to actually benefit the system around? And usually I find that transparency is what's really missing in the system, not you know, a particular bad behavior, but rather the pent up kind of tucked away behavior that leads to some consequence that's unintended or I guess not productive in whatever sense. So I really enjoy that line of thinking. And I think whenever you find one of these big problems that's being heavily invested into, like, stop, like, let's stop this problem, I think it's usually a sign there's something there that's, you know, maybe against the grain that might actually better assuage that energy buildup.
So it's like leverage it instead of stopping it, like funnel it, find a way to find the good in it.
You know, martial arts style, like just take in the energy and like guide it where you're trying to like guide the energy. You know, you don't
guide it onto the mat behind you as tackle it.
I think an analogous like situation is with quadratic voting, where there's this problem of whales, right? People have a lot of tokens. They control an outsized portion of the vote. That freaks people out. So they say, okay, we need to do quadratic voting or something like that, where whales get a proportionately smaller share of the vote. But then if you want to do this, you need to have kind of civil resistance. You need to start doing KYC for people. And you end up with all these like weird kind of downstream effects from this like one kind of root source of whales have too much power. And I think a lot of times it's easy to get caught up in this, like four or five layers down. But sometimes it's good to go back and think like, okay, how can we make it so that whales have the same incentives as everybody else? And maybe we don't have to do this whole kind of convoluted voting scheme that we're using.
Yeah, I can't stop thinking about it. I think, Django, you mentioned like in Discord, you know, people, or maybe I was just thinking this when you were talking, but like people posting spam in Discord servers. And it's like the initial reaction is to kick them out. Maybe they should just have to bid to be like the spam of the day, you know, and then you don't have that much spam and hopefully it's better spam, right? Yeah, or I mean, it makes me think.
You're going to allocate like money to have someone develop some scripts to like try to do the thing. Like, let's first think more creatively about, we don't want to, like, energy is good. In general, like energy is a sign of a system kind of, you know, itching for something. It doesn't really know what it wants, but it's there. And to like say like no energy is better than energy is last gasp solution. I think you know, trying to think more creatively about how to channel it or dance around it is always a not only a fun exercise, but sometimes leads to good outcomes.
I'm gonna go potentially way off on a tangent here and just ask you, is it important that we know that that's like human energy as opposed to like a bot that's just like built to like generate as much energy as possible in the direction of generating revenue for a particular thing? Like, cause I guess I feel much more comfortable saying, look, if a person somewhere in the world is sitting there trying to type a message to my Discord server, I should at least consider if there's some positive energy there versus if it's just like some AI spam bot.
It's a good point. I think, like either way, if you're like finding some creative way to deal with it is good. The bot problem is like, that's a real thing, right? Like I was thinking about this a lot today, even where, you know, a lot of people, like $100 million is pocket change for a lot of like ballsy people in the world. And it's pretty easy to create a bunch of wallets, distribute 100 million, maybe do a backlog of a month to 6 months of like social engagement on all of these accounts automatically. And then all of a sudden create like a charismatic persona to lead a meme coin and then have an illusion of hundreds of millions of dollars trickle in like, you know, recognizable patterns and then, you know, amplify, and then all of a sudden other people join into this thing. And like, not saying this is what's necessarily happening on a lot of these kind of narrative amplification processes in the market, but it's doable. And I think it's fair to assume if you're coming at it from the cynic's perspective, which I don't think is a bad perspective, like I tend to choose optimism at the expense of getting burnt a few times, but I feel like the cynics are also like in the right to acknowledge that like, hey, you're always kind of swimming in someone else's ocean here. Can't assume things are happening in a true human organic fashion. You know, like for you, 100 million seems something daunting, and like you can't fake it at that scale. But for a lot of folks, that's like, you know, it's worth planning a whole scheme for a little bit. And, you know, given cheap gas and given the tools we've built, it's pretty possible to come away, like with no scabs. So yeah, I think that's a great point, is like, you know, listening at least a little bit to that cynic in your head when like looking at all these things and assessing, okay, well, if it were to be bots or fake or whatever, do I want to participate or do I not want to participate? Do I want to fight it and spend my energy fighting a bot's energy? Or do I want to maybe, again, think more creatively and, all right, now that we are in this world of bots and of easily programmatic money, as well as posting with, you know, APIs only rate limited so much, what's my move? Is it to, you know, go out to the countryside and not touch a computer and kind of say, you know what, I'm at this point done with this computer internet game? Or is it to, you know, think, okay, where are we now? Where can we go from here?
Yeah, love that. All right, another good segue, thank you, to another article of the week, which is about quadratic voting. You know, Philip, you brought it up. Part of quadratic voting is about proving humanity. So the headline, and the article's from DAOtimes.com. The headline is, "This city pilots Web3 quadratic funding for public infrastructure. The city of Split, Croatia, is piloting an innovative new system for deciding how to fund municipal infrastructure projects." If anyone does not know what quadratic funding is in the audience, the idea, and you guys will have to correct me if I miss something here, but the idea is that there's some kind of matching fund. So let's say the city, let's talk about this example, says we have $1 million that's going to get spread out amongst 10 projects, but not evenly. It's going to depend on where people come and donate money. And so let's say you just had one person donating $1 to each of those 10 projects. The city would say, okay, people have kind of evenly expressed their interest, that we should split the $1 million 10 ways evenly. Now, let's say one of those people donates $100 to one and the other people just donate $1. If you were using a linear funding model, you would say, okay, well, that shows that there's 100 times as much interest in this project as the others. Let's just give, you know, $990,000 of the money to this project. What quadratic funding says is no, actually, the larger the quote unquote vote, the donation made by the individual person, the less we will value each marginal dollar. So that maybe, donating $100 only counts as 10 times as much voting power as donating $1 rather than 100 times as much. And you could change what that formula looks like. And so basically what that's doing is it's saying, look, we're always going to more heavily weight the $1 vote. In other words, just the fact that a person was willing to say, I support this thing, that's the strongest action you can take. And then the more and more and more money you give has some impact, but not an outsized impact, right? So that if you gave $5, that's not five times as much impact as one, but it's a bit more. And then again, if you give 100, it's not 20 times as much as five, but it's a bit more. And this has become popularized in Web3, especially by eluding me?
Does Bitcoin and Allo does a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And so now I love to see that this city is taking this on. Now you could do this without Web3. In fact, I have to think the idea was invented before Web3. It just happens to be a popular in Web3 since we're playing with these different governance models and voting models and DAOs and otherwise. But really cool to see that a city is doing this. I think there's a lot of potential here. Anything you guys want to weigh in on this one?
Quick question, actually. So I'm looking at this article and I'm having a hard time understanding what is actually being done. So is the idea that they give some budget to each citizen citizens can allocate that budget, and then those are quadratically weighted. Is that what they're doing?
My impression, just because I think this is the only way that the quadratic funding works, I think there has to be some kind of matching grant that gets divvied out based on how many people vote with how much of their own dollars to each of the items. But I guess not. I guess you could just, it doesn't have to even be donations, right? You could just say everyone gets 10 votes. And then if someone puts all 10 of their votes to one project, that only counts as like twice as much weight as if they gave one vote 10 times, maybe each of those has the full voting weight.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be too much of a hater on this city. I mean, and also I don't really understand what they're actually doing. So maybe they have like a great scheme going on and I'm just like misreading this article. But it's like in the context of funding public goods, it's like if everyone in the town, let's say 99% of people really want a new park to be built, and then one guy wants a swimming pool and nobody else in the town wants a swimming pool, I don't see why it's a good idea to like give the people who want the park less voting power and amplify the pool guy. Like, I don't know. I mean, quadratic voting is fundamentally amplifying. Like, I mean, at least in the context that I think this is in, it's amplifying the kind of like contrarian opinion. And I don't know if that's something you want to encourage in the context of like funding public goods for a town. The scheme is different, but this sounds like kind of a bad idea. I don't know.
I don't think that's how it works. I think if one person somehow voted 99 times, if everyone was given 100 votes, right?
Okay.
And I put 99 of mine on one, that would get downgraded to maybe only counting as like 5 or 10 votes. But if it's 99 people voting once each, that does have 99 times as much power as the one other person voting once, right?
Yeah, even so, it's like, so if someone has high, you're basically punishing people with high conviction on something. I don't really see. I mean, look, maybe there's a really great argument to be made here, but just on like an intuitive level, I don't really see how this is supposed to lead to like better public goods outcomes. And I also don't really understand why. I mean, it's cool that the blockchain is involved, but I don't really know why that's necessary here. Like, I assume this is only citizens of that city, so it kind of feels like. I don't know. I don't know how necessary all of this is.
Yeah, I see a little bit of both sides. I think it's a great use case to experiment with citizen-led allocation in governance for local governance. I think for if you already are paying taxes, some of which is earmarked for use in your municipality, it's great if that the decision of how it's used is also that's also a right given to the people, as opposed to triaged by some central entity, maybe across town or across the state, even across the country. I think a lot of problems in the real world can be solved with WhatsApp. I think a lot of the world uses WhatsApp, and WhatsApp groups coordinate the majority of the world, and there's no crypto involved, and there's a centralized behemoth in Meta behind it, but no one gives a damn. People just use it because it works. I think the actual accounting details matter less than actually just giving people participation with their neighbors in making decisions. And I think we'll be surprised at how many neighbors see eye to eye in terms of priorities, and also how many neighbors don't. So it's going to yield both interesting outcomes, like both cool outcomes and, oh yeah, we all wanted this pool, but then also a bunch of people maybe saying like, how dare you want the pool over this other thing? And then you just create another source of neighborhood drama, which can actually be kind of entertaining and productive. So in general, I think giving agency to people who already feel like they are at a burden paying taxes, I think is a logical progression of how local government works fiscally. I think it can be just a small part of the budget at first and then increase from there. I think only the government can do this, because if it was some citizen that, you know, folks were suspicious of having access to a few million dollars that they were, you know, promising to partition according to certain rules, all of a sudden that person is, you know, has a security risk behind them. So I think like government who has already the security backdrop and implications is the entity to come in and make that promise of like, hey, we have a voting system. Hey, we have a budget to allocate. We will execute this thing. I think the quadratic nuances is like so not relevant in this discussion. We have so much more to do, but maybe, you know, I'm in Brazil, and maybe the situation here of how we coordinate around public goods and public financing is different than in Croatia. Might be so much more advanced or more cordial in certain ways, more mathematically minded or economically minded in thinking, you know, in terms of quadratic being maximally efficient, you know, in certain quadrants of the trade-off spectrum. But I don't know. I think Split is a cool place to try it. I'm excited to see
it.
A great name for so many things. You know, it's great for splitting things and great for bananas if we want to start like have them also care about banana NFTs.
Split Croatia. Nice.
I don't know. Double down on Split being the experimental governance grounds of internet and banana things.
Well, and I want to dig into, you know, you mentioned the importance of this being done by a government. I think that actually calls to light the value of blockchain-based governance systems, which is that if you did it on the blockchain with something like Gitcoin, it doesn't have to be a government. You could trust the guy with $3 million because he could put it up into a smart contract that will allocate the money to the predetermined sources, and wherever people vote is where the money will go.
Do you want it to happen in the next few? Like the problem we're in is we have these tools, but if we were to enforce the usage of these tools, and 10 people would show up at the cafe when you were taking down names of like, hey, who wants to participate? If it's a WhatsApp group, maybe you'll have everyone participate, but you have different risks and different opportunities. I think government is at a cool place because it already is in the business of tracking people and keeping tabs of identity numbers and finances and data and all that stuff. So why not use that towards some empowering ends instead of, you know, watching all the other parks in the city get rebuilt except for the one next to your house.
I also feel bad because this article does not explain what's actually happening on chain or off chain at all. And it's very possible that there's some like brilliant funding scheme going on, and we're all just like criticizing it based on our own assumptions of whatever that means. So I don't know. I feel like we should get in the, at least I should get in the habit of like actually knowing what things are before making judgments of them.
There's a whole Notion site with all kinds of details. So maybe something people can look into later. It looks like it's at MUQA.org, Municipal Quadratic Funding Initiative. Let's turn to the last article of the week, although I'm sure we could stay on this one forever if we wanted to. The last article of the week is from Forbes, and the headline is Doomed to Fail: DAO's Steps to Overcome Pitfalls of Decentralization. A couple lines from the article, which is a bit clickbaity even once you read the article, but when someone says DAOs might be doomed to fail, my ears perk up. A couple of lines. One is, fully decentralized governance is a utopian vision for many in the Web3 sphere, but anyone who's ever tried to launch a DAO quickly discovers a hard truth: democracy ain't easy. For democracy to work, each vote requires coordination and, perhaps more importantly, voter engagement. A low turnout means that power becomes concentrated in an ever diminishing group. Now, the part that I want to comment on here, first of all, he doesn't even go on to say that DAOs are doomed to fail. He was just trying to ask a scary sounding question, but I certainly do not think they're anything like doomed to fail. I actually want to pick on this idea that voter engagement as measured by the percentage of people voting on every issue is necessarily so important. I think that's crazy. I think actually it makes a lot of sense, especially if you're trying to have a much more democratic form of organization where everyone can vote on everything. You don't need everyone to vote on everything. Right. In the day-to-day operations of a lot of organizations, many of the decisions, there's a small group of people who either know the most about it or care the most about it, or were delegated to try to help make that decision. Those people need to definitely be paying attention and voting. But if everyone else can just look at that vote and say, you know what, this is just an obvious, it's voting, it's 100% to zero in favor, and everyone's probably fine with this, I don't think that person needs to then go do a bunch of work to make sure that they shouldn't, you know, that it's okay that they're not voting. And if a vote comes up that's really contentious or risky or impactful, as long as there's a way to let everyone know that they should be, now they should be paying attention, and that they will step up and pay attention when it's really important that they do so, I think that's great. And again, I think it's kind of a silly idea to think that, you know, you need to always have a certain percentage of votes of the DAO participating in any action. So you guys feel free to pick on that issue or anything else from the article if you'd like.
What's the main context? So what was this DAO that actually failed in the article? Do you know what happened there?
Well, it's based on an academic who analyzed nearly 5,000 DAO voting events and published the results of their findings under the provocative title, The Illusion of Democracy, Why Voting in Decentralized Autonomous Organizations is Doomed to Fail. And the findings supposedly show that DAOs are inherently susceptible to low voter participation, putting them at risk of centralizing their decision-making power and defeating their own objective. So this was actually an academic paper, now that I've clicked on it, from NYU School of Law that was published about a month ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very dramatic paper, but there are DAOs that are like, that by existence kind of disprove this. So I don't know. It's kind of like, how much credit do you want to give that idea? I mean, voter apathy is certainly an issue for a lot of DAOs. But I it's hard to say, like, you know, if that's kind of like a horrible thing and this is like a fundamental flaw of DAOs, or if the DAOs that do get vote loader turnout are just DAOs which people don't care about as much. And that's kind of how things should work. If people don't care about it, like it doesn't matter what happens to it. I don't know where I really fall there.
I think even in DAO world, similar to most other things, people put their energy behind something they believe in. Their energy can be their money, their time, their contribution, their passion, their love. I don't think majority of people put all of their any of the above. I don't think any like people put their energy into the belief that they can vote as like the primary function of why they're, you know, allocating towards a DAO in order to maybe have some membership criteria. And I think a lot of the membership criteria has been somewhat of a like a legal dance over the past while to kind of like create a sense of purpose around these tokens, these kind of reciprocal things that you get when you do pour your time, your energy, your money, your passion into something. I think what gets lost in the sauce here is as people are pouring their energy into things, they want something to happen. They want, and I think we also get lost in the sauce thinking that something to happen is number go up or price go up or token go up. So there's these two ends of the spectrum, right? One is like what needs to happen is number go up ASAP, and then the other is what needs to happen is you know, let's really get governance right. Like we're pouring all this energy in to get governance right, which is, that's not the case. Usually like governance is a necessary aspect of navigating leadership towards certain ends. It's always been that way in corporate ends and, you know, like forever. And a DAO is an interesting new way to do it. You still need leadership and you still need to take this energy and do something incredible with it. And so Spending our time just, you know, thinking about DAOs as a governance for the sake of better governance, for the sake of better governance, like loses so much of that energy dissipates. Whereas like, I think the strongest actual DAOs recognize like people are putting in a lot of their time, money, energy into these things. And it's a privilege to kind of help steward that energy in like very productive ends, right? Like furthering either a mission statement or an idea of how of what the future should be, or creating something that, you know, folks will artistically admire. Whatever it is, I doubt most people are pouring their time, energy, and money into governance for the sake of governance. And so I think despite some DAOs maybe claiming to, you know, have this figured out, and they spend a lot of the time kind of on the meta governance aspect of things, the most interesting projects, I think, are recognizing that, like, okay, this energy that's being contributed, don't take it for granted. There's a lot of people who like give a damn, and just do something with, like, do something amazing with it. Like, make something memorable, make something bigger than it was, more sustainable than it was. And then the governance question will be such a, like, you know, great. If governance was a product, was a part of making that happen, great. If not, like, great. But like the focus is like, do the thing, you know, and, you know, maybe strive towards a lot of these votes that are, you know, less controversial because you've built out leverage over time, you know, asking for bite sizes from a DAO until you've earned trust and you've proved that you can allocate capital, which is the hardest thing for an investor is, you know, to pour money into something that they feel whoever is stewarding the funds, be it governance or, you know, a person, like a leader, to actually steward those resources towards productive ends so that they can give them more capital to then, you know, steward towards productive ends. And if I think it's an investor's nightmare if that energy dissipates in the meta governance process. But it's also, you know, a big part of what we're doing here is asking a question of like, hey, in this post board / executive world, what does it mean for everyone to have a voice in these executive decisions? But I think it almost like teleologically work itself out once great things are built. We'll look back at what the great systems of governance were that enabled those great things to be built, as opposed to, you know, finding the great system that can then build the great thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, to me, one of the reasons why a lot of people working in the DAO space do spend a lot of time pontificating and thinking about how to do governance right is that because it's done through technology, you have to know you have to figure out what you're building the technology to enable. So you are kind of forced to think about, okay, what is a governance model or some set of governance models we want to build for? And I think that does kind of force people to be very governance first, at least if you're building those tools, even though, to your point, like, the point of governance is not to exist for its own sake, at least most of the time, is to enable something to happen. So I do want to move on from this because I really want to get into the more in-depth interview with the two of you. But this has been an awesome Just DAO at News report, and I'm going to do a quick segue and then we'll get right back into talking. The quick segue is just to do a brief ad for MyDAO, my company. Just letting everyone know that we do DAO LLCs. These are legal entities for DAOs in the Marshall Islands. You can find us at mydao.org. We have a network of lawyers from all over the world and tax advisors who focus on DAOs. So if anyone is looking for help with that kind of thing, please reach out. Or if you are a lawyer or other type of professional advisor who wants to get into DAOs, let me know and I'm happy to help you do that. All right, turning to the featured guest interview. So, Philip, you've been on the show before. You told us how you got into Web3. So in the interest of time, let's just ask Django that question, and then we'll turn to what are you guys working on and how does it relate to DAOs, and we'll go from there. So for now, Django, how did you get into Web3 and DAOs in the first place?
I'll try to do a quick summary here. I think everyone's got long stories. So I've been building stuff my whole life. Got into technology via building musical projects that needed then websites and distribution. So then I started building websites and then realized, oh, like I have this weird affection for Apple products. And then I wanted to build an iOS app. This was early college, and then kind of built this app for roommates and landlords. And then that kind of brought me into money moving world of like, okay, now like managing payments between people who share stuff and also between landlords. So a lot of like high volume interactions brought me into like working with banks and banking APIs. And then like, this was like me and my friend and we kind of at some point hit this point where we like building product and having people around in our Slack channel, both landlords and roommates, just whoever was using the app as well as ourselves. And so charging fees was always hard because, you know, we were always pinned against one another in a way, and our body of users were investors, landlords. So, you know, it felt always weird to charge fees. And that kind of brought this whole philosophical questioning of what's the cap, like, how does money and debt work in this software world? And why are we using similar systems today than we were using for building railroads, you know, 100 years ago? In that, you know, you have this thing that you can distribute many copies of for free. So you basically go into debt to build something. A lot of VCs want to give you money. And then you're trying to build this $1 billion thing that can then just extract $10 a month from a lot of people when like the unit costs are zero. I had this thought where if I could say how much I need to run something up front, to run this app, right? Let's say I need 20K a month because I need to pay myself X. I need to be able to say how much I need. Whoever else is working needs to be able to say how much they need. We can easily account for databases, servers, et cetera. Let's say it's 20K a month. Then we can charge whatever, say 20 bucks, sliding scale. If we don't make that much this month, then we will turn off the app. No big deal. Like we'll stop working on it. If we make more, then we can push everyone's prices towards zero. So then everyone can be part of this marketing engine and grow word of mouth, which they're already doing. The more people who pay the $10 a month, the more we get overflow past our 20K ask or need. And then the more we can then push everyone's price down towards zero as the network grows, because our unit costs are zero. So, you know, we have fixed costs and we can grow from there. Turns out coding such a thing and working with banks is a pain in the ass, especially when your largest transactions are fraudulent. There's people stealing renters' identities and trying to move payments and steal money from one another, of which we're liable in that situation. And then at the same time, DeFi summer is hitting and one of my roommates is working at Coinbase and he's like working on Coinbase Pro as Bitcoin hits 20K for the first time and then crashes back down to 10K in the course of like 24 hours. So he's like trying to keep the site up. I'm, you know, like have just been putting some into some shit coins at the time as like an onlooker, but still learning a lot from my roommate. And then I never really understood the programmatic implication until I started reading these DeFi contracts from you know, compound contracts, the earn contracts. Like some engineers that I still really look up to, and realize, oh, like in order to code this money routine, that there's inflows and there's also outflows. Smart contracts are clearly better than banking APIs and will solve the job and also mitigate a lot of the burden from stolen identities and whatnot that banks impose. And then it was like, stop everything. And I needed to build that money engine, which became Juicebox. And then now we're back to building applications that can now use Juicebox as like the money revenue capital formation engine behind the scenes.
Wow, that is really interesting. I love that. So let's go a little bit into Juicebox. Is Juicebox a way for renters and landlords to pay their bills? Or I feel like it's become something much more than that.
Oh, it's not. No. Like it's the business model that sits beside it. So imagine where if you were to take a fee in that previous, let's say you impose $5 fee on each rent transaction. Where does that fee go? Okay, you can route it to your bank, then you can accumulate fees in your bank, and then you can manage expenses like payouts from your bank, by clicking buttons or calling your banker, by going to the branch or whatever, signing a check. That's an option. Or you can route your fee into Juicebox, right? Into your project's Juicebox, which also, from the investment angle, same thing. Where do investors go to give you money? They go to your bank, they'll just deposit the money. You have some side legal contract agreement there. And the Juicebox world, that legal agreement is baked in, but it's also where investors would go to put the money in. So both consumers paying fees and investors are treated similarly from money in. The deal is kind of like constructed ahead of time for those who want to participate. And then the deal evolves over time preemptively as the project owner, the address who owns the NFT, chooses to schedule these changes over time. And so really the power belongs to this NFT holder of each project who is scheduling these money IO routines along the way. But and it ends up just being a great place to take in just open contributions from whomever. So it's just a button you click. There's no criteria or rules that you have to meet to participate. And also a great place to route fees.
I think for some listeners, it might be helpful to go into like the basics of how Juicebox actually works on chain. Does that sound good to you guys?
Yeah, and what's it for? If I hadn't led the leading question, it's not for renters,
totally.
Right? Because yeah. It's obviously not, right? People use Juicebox, and I know about Juicebox. People use Juicebox to raise money, at least from my perspective, for all kinds of projects, Web3 especially, but Web3 and otherwise. But yeah, so what is it for and how does it work, please?
Yeah, so at a high level, there are some like different versions of Juicebox and stuff like that, but at a high level, the fundamental is that you have what's called a Juicebox project. So anyone can make one of these projects. And what happens is anyone can pay into one of these projects, like Django mentioned, and in exchange, they receive some of that project's tokens. So the funds that are paid in they don't go to the owner's wallet. They are actually held within this kind of project treasury, which can back the value of the tokens. So when people have their tokens, and if they disagree with like the direction that the project is kind of heading in, they can burn their tokens and reclaim a proportional share of the money that's inside of the treasury. But then there are a bunch of little kind of like exceptions and things you can move around. So one is that the amount of tokens that people get, that's not a fixed amount of tokens over time. So the person who owns the project can set it up in a way such that the people who pay into the project earlier on get more tokens for each ETH they pay in. People who pay in later get fewer tokens. And you can do this to kind of, reward people who are taking a greater risk by paying in earlier. And then on the other end, they can do a similar thing where people who redeem earlier get actually a little bit less of the underlying treasury, which is backing these tokens. And people who redeem later get proportionately a little bit more of that. And you can control the degree to which each of these incentives is applying and use that to kind of tailor the action that people are taking. So if you want to encourage people to hold on to their tokens a little bit longer and maybe not redeem quite so quickly, you can make that ratio of how much money people get back when they're redeeming earlier as opposed to later. You can make that greater or less depending on what behavior you're trying to encourage. So, go ahead, Django.
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. but of course this works well for the kinds of things that like Django and was talking about, where you have fees going somewhere, you kind of want to manage them in a programmatic way. But it turns out that a lot of problems that people try to solve generally with money and organizing map very well to this problem, where you have some sort of treasury. You have some sort of payments coming in, you have some sort of token, the token might be used for voting or doing something else. And then you can evolve this stuff over time. And I'm kind of abridging this here, right? Like the treasury, for example, has like, you can manage payouts and do like recurring payouts and things like that. There are a few other kind of incentives that you can control. But the general idea is that you have this like crypto treasury, which there are other kinds of treasuries out there. You have the token and you have, there are other tokens that you can use as an alternative. But what makes Juicebox unique is that it kind of tightly couples those two things in a way where you get these nice kind of emergent properties. So people use it for DAOs, people use it for like huge crowdfunding campaigns, people use it for art projects, people use it to fund open source software, pretty much anything where you have some kind of community and you're kind of trying to manage something within that community or just align incentives in some kind of way.
The largest and most notable projects now are there's the fundraiser for the Tornado Cash developers legal defense that's ongoing. I think it might have just ended, so hopefully I'll get into that. In the past, we've seen Constitution DAO is a common one. Remember, there's Shark DAO who contributed to buying 5 of the first 20 nouns as a group and several in between. It's funny, like I think of Juicebox as a language. It's very open-ended. There's like, you know, certain things at our disposal that we can kind of organize in different ways, but it doesn't really give you much structure as to how you can organize it. So it's pretty open-ended. And I think we found that the majority of people have used it for very straightforward things, like the token redemption idea Philip was talking about is mostly just used for refunds. You know, like I put in funds, the campaign doesn't work. Oh, I can get my token back and get refund. That's useful, turns out. And likewise, for fundraisers, if like all funds that come in go out to another wallet to then bid on something or contribute to a certain cause, so nothing stays in the treasury reclaimable by token holders until there's like a refund moment. And so despite being a pretty open-ended language, thus far, we've just seen the simple cases explored in practice. Obviously, showing the extent of what the protocol can do on clients like Juicebox.money is hard. It's hard to weigh all of the features in like fair ways on screen. So you have to choose audiences to cater towards. And that's a great evolution to kind of realize that. But I think we're just beginning now. Having bandwidth after years of, you know, launching a protocol and then really trying to like make it evolvable while managing risks that hold beneath and still, running on its like Juicebox as an org runs as project ID number one on the protocol. So we've used our own tools on the way there and, you know, seen firsthand, we've probably put the most stress on the protocol ourselves. So after a few years of more risk mitigation and like creating a structure that works well, and then now into this more omni-chain world where we're not just going to be on mainnet, we're going to have treasuries all over the place that are kind of chain agnostic. It doesn't matter where your network is, you can be on any chain. Now we get to think the work that all of us have been wanting to do, which is build Juicebox projects. Like, no one wants to spend time building Juicebox. Like, I think everyone, like, that's just a byproduct of us now getting to do what we want to do, which is, create the things that we want to create artistically or technologically or experimentally, whatever, and have the engine that is flexible and has mostly been used in pretty vanilla ways, now being able to bend it in just the right ways that, you know, we really see the benefit of doing.
Interesting. So could you talk about Juicebox for DAOs? So I think classically, in one way of thinking about DAOs is they often will launch a token, sell that token in some manner. You know, in the Nouns ecosystem, it's a daily auction. Some other DAOs might do it as like just an initial offering kind of approach, where they sell them all up front, retain some for the investors and the founders, and then they just, it floats on the open market. Is Juicebox a way of doing those things? Is it different? And how can DAOs leverage Juicebox?
Yeah, I think DAOs using Juicebox get a few nice things out of the box. So one is that, like Django said, it's like a pretty expressive language. Depending on what kind of behavior you're trying to encourage, like if you want to encourage people to hold onto their tokens for a longer time, if you want to encourage like more people to kind of like buy them up, and you can set up your project in a way such that that's encouraged. But what's nice about it is that each of these kind of incentives, there's only really one number to look at. So someone who knows how Juicebox projects work, like if I go and see a new Juicebox project, I only have to look at maybe 10 numbers, and then I know exactly what the project is doing under the hood. So instead of having to read through like this long like legal process or whatever, I can do diligence on what's actually happening with my money, how many tokens I'm getting, and how the project can evolve over time pretty much immediately, right? So that's one really nice thing, is that it gives people confidence when paying the project because they know what's going on. And then they also get certain guarantees. So the project can be set up in a way such that people are guaranteed kind of like a bit of redemption or something like that, or that the token supply is capped and that they don't have to worry about new tokens being issued. So the diligence and kind of confidence when paying a project is one thing. There's also kind of the token model, which is underlying it. So a lot of DAOs will run into an issue where they have a fixed supply of tokens and they're selling them at a fixed price. And this can work well, but there can also be shortcomings where maybe they don't sell all of those tokens and then it like kind of looks like people aren't actually that excited to be a part of the DAO, or maybe they do sell all of the tokens and then there are a bunch of other people who really wanted the token and couldn't get it, and then the DAO is kind of undercapitalized, you know, so to speak, relative to the kind of public demand. So Juicebox is nice in that tokens are issued on a continuous basis, but you can still control the incentives of how that evolves over time, or like the kind of arc of how that evolves over time. So within the bounds of what you set up, it can kind of respond to the market in a very natural way, if this makes sense. I might be getting a little too into the details here. Yeah, I don't know if you want to.
Two examples that I think will tie this together. They're both DeSci projects, which I think have found a little bit of a niche using Juicebox to fundraise as DAOs. First is MoonDAO, which is now a year and a half or more old, maybe going on 2 years now. They had a great setup where they set there's a lever in Juicebox language called the reserved rate. They set it to 50% and they issued 1 million Moonie tokens per ETH coming in. That was the boundary, and it ran for one lunar cycle for 28 days. So for 28 days, anyone could come in and contribute one ETH and get 500,000 Moonie tokens. And 500,000 would go into the DAO's reserve. You had to trust the founder, like the people kind of trying to motivate this, because initially the project is owned by a multi-sig, owned by a few people, so very few checks and balances, and they had to earn the folks' trust, which is a large prereq of the stuff, even on chain. But you know, they put in their funds, and you know, folks kind of learned that, hey, we do have this mission as our only focal point. In MoonDAO's case, it's getting to the moon as a DAO and like a democratizing exploration of space. So they ran a very successful multi-million dollar fundraise during that 28 days. And then they shut off funding from then on out and stopped issuance of Moonie, and have since thrown away the keys to the Juicebox. So basically those first 28 days are the only thing that's ever happened. The treasury got half of the token supply. The other half was distributed to folks who contributed in. So the end result is a distribution of Moonie, who are governing a treasury of ETH and Moonie. And with just that initial resources, just those initial resources, they were able to conduct the first set of auctions. So anyone who contributed got a chance to be on one of the Blue Origin trips up to lower Earth orbit, I believe. And so, you know, it's a bunch of billionaires and influencers on that ship, except for a few folks chosen by the MoonDAO community. So it's pretty cool. And then CryoDAO this past December, and largely over the past year, ran a similar campaign with similar parameters, a lot more drawn out, but similarly, half of the tokens to the treasury, half of the tokens go out to contributors, and then you know everyone's got a fixed rate, and then whoever wants to get in, and then time's up, and then now you have a network that can then evolve from there with a budget.
Interesting, cool. Yeah,
I'll mention one more thing that was important about these projects, which is that like logistically, as a DAO, it's not so crazy to set this stuff up because Juicebox interoperates with a bunch of other DAO tooling out there. So both of those projects, their projects were actually owned by a Gnosis Safe multisig NFT up front. So people had this guarantee about multisig signers. And then they were able to conduct voting pretty easily through Snapshot because the Juicebox project tokens, you can either like read them directly with a Snapshot strategy for them. Juicebox projects can also have ERC-20 tokens. So if you're using like on-chain governance or something like that, it's not so crazy to like interop with other popular DAO tools.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Well, I highly recommend people check out Juicebox. I've kind of gotten to use it as part of some projects I've been with. I've never gotten to launch one myself. It's something I hope to get to do soon. But let's talk a little more about DAOs. You know, the audience of the show is really into DAOs. I feel like you guys are part of the Juicebox DAO. You may be part of other projects in the ecosystem. You see people using Juicebox for their DAOs. Do you have like a key takeaway that you want to share with people from having experienced DAOs a lot over the past few years? You know, imagine listeners might be newer to DAOs. Do you have a piece of advice or another tool you'd recommend they check out or a favorite resource or any of the above?
I think one of my favorite ideas of being highly active in the Juicebox DAO community over the past few years has been the idea of the DAO's immune system. So the DAO is like a biological entity. It's alive. It's an organism, and it has an immune system, right? And its immune system is tasked with being defensive when there's pathogens, you know, who maybe are trying to propose work that is extractive of the resources available. But it's also, its job is to let in and take risk, you know, it's to allow folks to come in, build leverage, and show stewardship over the network such that it can stand a chance to survive, right, to grow, to sustain itself. And I think this when I returned to this idea during governance and during like particularly contentious moments of like, hey, okay, some decision has to be made here, or we have to, you know, get out of this limbo state into resolve one way or another. I think about the DAO's immune system and the precedents that are being set, and you know, what is the risk appetite right now? Are we at a stage where lenience is important to get more information so that we can grow? Or do we have enough information so that we can act according to our instincts here? And then we, in that circumstance, usually falls back to a person, like I can only act for myself. And I've built up certain leverages and certain influences over time. And those are also at risk for me. You know, I just kind of act according to my own current instinct. I don't do a lot of like self-reflecting and questioning before I blurt stuff out. But I'm very aware that, hey, like this, the my role in this DAO's immune system is non-negligible. And the DAO can easily lose that faith in my voice and kind of my participation here. And so, you know, both positively and negatively, if I, as part of this immune system, act one way or another. I think a lot of people go into this without understanding or really thinking through what this metaphor means, what this analogy means. It's that you need to take risks. You need to take risks. You need to open up your treasury and do things proactively. Being overly defensive it hurts sometimes. You know, getting too much capital up front and then feeling like you have to defend it doesn't give you space to move or dance or like really organically find who's around for the right reasons to like help motivate things towards productive ends. And starting small is really nice. Starting from just a button where you have no one there and then working your way up just by like being present yourself, being active yourself, and participating as just like anyone else could, is a great way to start to develop this immune system grassroots, because starting from, you know, a large airdrop is, to me, a terrible way to develop a DAO's immune system, because now you're automatically on defense. You've launched and you're automatically on hyper defensive alert. And a lot of people, the only way out of it is to do retroactive everything. Like, we're only going to do retroactive rewards. We're only going to, like, let people, you know, really earn it before doing anything. And then you lose a lot of the people who have a little bit more self-respect than that. Who, like, want to kind of, like, steward something and be trusted and, like, you know, want to be a part of something. You want to negotiate trust in a way that's not adversarial. And so I think the immune system is a good metaphor for, like, you know, like, you have to learn by just taking these risks on both. I guess there's a technological risk, but I'm talking more of the social governance risk of saying, like, great, here's a proposal process. We don't really know if this can work, but we have to see if you can manage this capital, right? Either to pay yourself or to then redelegate or whatever.
Yeah, I think a related danger, which I see a lot of project creators and just people working up, I'm speaking about Juicebox project creators because that's what I have the most experience with. But I think people starting DAOs generally will often fall into this danger where they, like, don't fully commit to one way of doing something, where they, like, think they want something, but they don't actually want that thing. Like, one common thing is, like, ownership and scope of governance. Right. So they have this kind of stated idea that they think they should want to be fully decentralized. But then when it actually comes down to it, they realize that's not what they want. And it leads to all these crazy conflicts and issues and social drama. And, like, it's just not a good thing. So I really encourage people who are making DAOs or any kind of project to really question the assumptions that they have when they're going into this, because it's easy to say that you want something when in practice it's not actually what you want to do.
It's all adversarial. Like, you may want something because you have the best intentioned in mind. But the moment you've created a certain set of rules, or, you know, either social rules or, like, it's hard to think adversarially. It's hard to think, like, how does this both prop up the well-meaning players as well as, not necessarily just prevent bad actors, but rather, as we talked about earlier, like, try to utilize that energy in productive ways.
Yeah, it's important to think, like, if I were trying to destroy this DAO, if I was someone else who was trying to destroy this DAO, what would I do in light of this idea that I have?
And usually, people who are trying to destroy the DAO are the smartest people who want to realize, oh, I don't have access in the way I thought. Like, I have respect for, you know, the thinking and the people I actually want to befriend, or actually, you know, want to make this more of a communal relationship as opposed to an adversarial one.
Yeah, definitely. If I could give one more tip.
Sure, please do.
Making DAOs. This is also related. I think a lot of people will start a DAO and then see other DAOs doing things and assume that they have to do things in the same way. And in that, there can be a lot of danger because you're kind of taking all of these assumptions and maybe your circumstances are not the same as this other DAO. Or if nothing else, it's like this could be added complexity, which makes it harder to interact with your DAO that you just don't need. That doesn't really serve to better outcomes. So, like, always think about, like, what are the outcomes that I want and how does this serve better outcomes, right? Like, if you're governing a DeFi protocol and you're setting up governance, it's like, what is a good governance outcome and how can I consistently encourage this over time?
Yeah, totally. Sorry, another thing. Now you've got us on a roll.
Perfect.
It's so easy to be nice to people. And it's, it's like it's good to be nice to people. It's good to be welcoming, encouraging. But on the tools train that Philip's mentioning, you have to believe in something. And you have to believe in something enough to say no to just about every piece of marketing that comes into your public comms channel saying, hey, I'm also a nice person and building a cool thing that y'all should use. It's so easy to be nice to that person and be like, oh, let's try it. Let's spend time trying to figure out how this flow works into our flow and this, that, and the other. But I think first introspecting as to, like, what are your needs? Like, what's currently, like, top priority. We need to solve a problem and then see, oh, is anyone around that maybe has something here? But man, like there's a lot of people who you can be nice to, and it feels good to be nice to people. But it doesn't really, for again, going back to those folks who are pouring their money, time, and energy into things, like they're not doing it for you to be nice to people. You know, you're doing it because you believe in something and you have a vision that you want to work towards.
Yeah.
So do that first and foremost. Do the fuck out of that.
So much good advice. And I love that. To me, actually, a lot of what you guys are talking about is about leadership. And I don't think a lot of DAOs are afraid of the word leadership, but initially it can be scary because leadership sounds very similar to management. And I think a lot of DAOs are afraid of management, at least having a centralized management and hierarchy. But I think DAOs need leadership maybe more than traditional organizations do, because there is no one at the top who's telling you this is exactly what you can do and you can't do. And so you need something like an immune system, which I think is an awesome analogy. Sure. Because I think actually like the human body is a good analogy in general, in that in some ways it's a thing, it's an organization. Like from the outside, you can say, well, Adam is centralized, he's one person. But inside, it's totally decentralized, right? All these organs are operating sometimes in conflict with each other, push and pull, you know, finding balance. And without the immune system, you know, none of that would work. And of course, you'd also be open to these outside attacks. And even Django talking about what to me, you know, you were saying as a leader, I think you're both leaders. And certainly Django has always been, you know, one of the recognized leaders of Juicebox. Even if not having official, you know, management power, being authentic while also being thoughtful about how your words and actions affect others. That's another really important quality for leaders. And so lots of really good advice. We have to close. Unfortunately, we're about at time. So would each of you, and if you want to try to fit one more thing in your closing words, like another DAO someone should check out or some other thing, you know, to be excited about, that's fine. But would each of you please share with the audience, where can people find you and Juicebox on the web or on social?
The best place is the Juicebox Discord. So it's just discord.gg/juicebox. And there's also like a Telegram and stuff like that. But my name is Philip and all of those, Philip V. So you can tag me there.
Awesome. And how about you, Django?
Django in all the places. Me_Django on Twitter or X, and Django and Warpcast around. One thing I'll plug is if you see this banana around in the next few months, don't take it at face value. I mean, you can't take it at face value. There's a lot there, but also dig in and ask questions as to how it's working under the scenes and throughout it. You'll see some evolved Juicebox stuff and some interesting revenue models, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, and you guys told me about some of the new stuff that you're alluding to in Denver. I don't know how much is public yet, but people should definitely pay attention to Juicebox in the coming months. There's some really interesting stuff that they will be announcing, apparently involving a banana, as Juicebox has always involved a walking anthropomorphic banana in a lot of their materials, as you can see if you're watching it live on the screen. In conclusion, you can find me on the web. I'm 0xThriller on X, or The Thriller on Farcaster. My DAO is at MyDAODS for Marshall Islands DAO Directory Services on Twitter, or just MyDAO.org. Again, if you're thinking about legal issues for your DAO or Web3 project, especially legal entities, please check out the Marshall Islands. Reach out if you need a lawyer, if you need a tax advisor. We've got DAO-focused lawyers and tax advisors we can introduce you to. None of this is ever or has been legal advice. We're not lawyers. At least I'm not a lawyer. It's not tax advice. It's not financial advice. And again, thank you guys so much for coming on the show. It's been fun, and I really appreciate it.
Can I do one more thing? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm not going to stop you.
Okay, I want to shout out RevNets really quickly, because we kind of alluded to this a few times throughout the show. So what Django mentioned earlier, where like this idea of DAOs, how can we take it further and remove this kind of governance management burden and risk, frankly. So if you go to RevNet, RevNet.eth.limo, you can see a little bit more about this. But the idea is that it's a subset of Juicebox, where you kind of restrict some of the features. So one is that everything has to be set up ahead of time, right? Like a juice box project can be evolved over time. RevNet, you have to set everything up ahead of time. It can still evolve, but in a way that you set up back before you launched it. There's no payouts. And then everything is kind of defined by the token. So the only way money can come in or leave the treasury is through either people either buying the token or burning their tokens to claim some money back. So it's a pretty interesting way to like run an ungoverned network. I don't know if you have anything else to add, Django, but if you're interested in that, go to that website. There's like a Discord, a Telegram. People can check it out and learn more.
Yes, start there and reach out if you're curious.
Yeah, really exciting. It's kind of mind-blowing when you just think about it. It's a whole new financial approach or model or system that really has never been used before, because it wouldn't have been possible before Web3, and no one, I guess, had thought of it until you guys did. So definitely check it out. So for everyone who's thinking about starting a DAO, everyone in the audience, are you thinking about starting a DAO? Just DAO it.